four beautiful women, all victims of brutal attacks with a knife. One survivor who managed to fight for her life. Over the span of 25 years, three of the women wound up dead, including one just 18 years old. At the center of it all, one man who managed to evade the police for nearly three decades. Welcome to the Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood podcast. We go deep into the case and how detectives pieced it all together, speak with key experts who investigated each of the gruesome attacks, and a comprehensive recap of a three-month trial that threatened to sentence the suspect to death. Plus, we'll break down how an Illinois state attorney's office may have dropped the ball by not locking up the killer before he attacked two more women. The twists and the turns of this case that has star power, controversial evidence, three families whose lives will never be the same. And what's next with yet another trial looming over the years to come? I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Hollywood Ripper. The Hollywood Ripper case didn't begin in Hollywood. It started in Chicago, in a Cook County, Illinois suburb called Glenview. A bright 18-year-old named Trisha Boccaccio was days away from leaving Glenview to attend Purdue University on an engineering scholarship. She was smart and popular. She took calculus, was a dedicated athlete. She was on the debate team and hung out with her friends, often at the Lake Avenue TGI Fridays in Glenview. That's where she was the night of August 13th, 1993. As she often did, Trisha was out with friends, taking part in a road rally scavenger hunt, one of the last times she would be able to see her friends before leaving for college. Around 40 people attended the rally, and after dinner, Trisha and her friends hung out in the parking lot of Glenbrook South High School. Then she dropped two of them off at their cars before heading home. Happy times. Those are times when you think about when you're in high school and you realize that part of your life is going to change. You are going to have different experiences because you are graduating from high school and you are essentially closing one chapter in your life and beginning a new chapter of excitement, moving as Trisha was to a new place, to meet new friends and to have new experiences. And those are happy times, times of joy to enjoy with your friends and be with your friends and excited for the new adventures that you're going to experience. I remember being in high school and about everyone was graduating and going their separate ways. And those were memorable, exciting times of graduation day and getting ready for graduation and the new journey in your life. That's exciting times. That's what Trisha was going through, the next chapter in her life and getting ready to start that exciting new chapter. Let's bring in Doug Longini, investigator reporter and former producer for CBS News 48 Hours. He also worked for the Chicago Reporter, ABC 7, and NBC 5. Doug, tell us a little bit about Glenview, Illinois.
Glenview, Illinois is a suburb north of Chicago. About 1993, it was about 37,000 people. It was on the train track that heads down to downtown Chicago, so a lot of commuters. So largely, certainly in 1993, white city, middle class, very, very low crime. Lord knows there probably have been very few murders in the history of Glenview. Very nice place to live, a suburb full of trees, and at that time, modest homes. Today, not much more high end, but at that time in 1993, a town of fairly modest homes.
Doug, what do you know about Tricia?
Tricia Picaccio lived in Glenview, Illinois. Her parents were Rick Picaccio and Diane Picaccio. In 1993, Rick worked for Bell Telephone. He was a technician for them. And Diane worked at a veterinary animal clinic in a suburb nearby. Tricia had two siblings, both younger. Doug, I think about a year younger than her. And Tommy, probably about 5 years younger than her. They lived in Glenview. They lived in a modest-sized home on a good-sized corner lot. And Tricia went to high school in Glenview. She was a straight-A student, at least that's what I've read. Was on the debate team. I think loved the debate team. Was social, had her friends. Had a boyfriend. Maybe, you know, during high school, maybe more than one boyfriend. I don't know. But she had a boyfriend, and she was heading off to college. She was going to go to Purdue University in Lafayette, Indiana. Purdue is known for its engineering program, and that's the major that Tricia was going to take up. So in August of 1993, she was going to head off to Purdue for her college experience. So Trish Picaccio had been out with her friends, a lot of her high school friends, on the night of August 13th, 1993, Friday the 13th. And later in the evening, probably around between midnight and 1 a.m., she took a couple of her friends home, and then she went home in Glenview. And their home, the way it's situated, it's on a large corner lot. And the front of the house has a circular driveway. And then pretty far down on the side of the house is the driveway into the garage. And that evening, Trisha drove a blue Mercury Cougar, and she parked her car in front of the house on the circular driveway. And that's all we know at that point. Sometime in the night, her mom, Diane, wakes up. She wants to check on if Tricia got home. She looks out the front window and sees that Tricia's Cougar is parked out in front, feels that fine, she's at home, goes back to bed. That morning, about 6 a.m., Diane gets up and leaves for work early for the animal clinic, the veterinary clinic, and backs out of the garage, backs out the driveway, onto the street, and heads over to the animal clinic. Later, her father, Rick, guesses around 8:30. He's up, and he's going to put some tools in his van, and I gather the van was sitting out in the driveway, and he walks out and he looks over to his left, and as he says, he sees two little tennis shoes pointing up on the side porch, and it's his daughter, Tricia, and he goes over, and Tricia is lying there, and there's blood everywhere. And she's been stabbed. And as Rick told us when we interviewed him for CBS News, he died at that moment. Now, Rick Boccaccio was a tough guy. You can kind of tell that. And he had been in the military during Vietnam. I don't know what action he saw or didn't see, but he had been in Vietnam. But nothing prepared him for what he saw that morning. And Tricia was lying face up. She'd been stabbed in multiple parts of her body. Her car keys were over on the pavement. And I don't know what Rick did next, but I do know that Doug Boccaccio, Trisha's younger brother, ran upstairs, got Trisha's phone in her room, and called for help. Trisha's younger brother, Tommy, had been in his bedroom. He heard Doug. Then he sees Doug yelling, and then Doug rips, I don't know what room, but rips the blinds off the wall. Two boys come downstairs. They get to the family room. They look out the bay window, which also has a door, which would then the door Tricia would have come in. And they see their sister lying under a white sheet with one of her arms sticking out from the sheet.
At the sight of Trisha's body on the doorstep, Rick dropped his coffee and ran over to her. He attempted to revive her, but her body felt cold, and she still had her keys in her hand, like she was trying to get in the side door. Neighbors heard him scream, and several came over. Diane, Trisha's mom, had already left for work and got a call from her husband, Rick. He had called her just before that to tell her Trisha wasn't home. They assumed she had slept over a friend's house who lived across the street and had a party the night before. When Rick called Diane back to tell her he had found Trisha's body, Diane grabbed her keys and ran out the door. A technician she worked with offered to give her a ride home, but Diane said no. She got in her car and drove home. When she arrived, police cars were already at the house. Police prevented her from getting close to her daughter. Can you only imagine the horrific news that a mother must have that she's lost her child? Children are supposed to outlive their parents, not the other way around. Words can't express what Diane was going through as she heard about her daughter and was driving there only to show up with the police being there and not able to see her daughter. The emotions that she must experience, a mother should never have to have the loss of their own daughter, with a daughter that had so many beautiful dreams and had such a bright future, to have that bright future taken from her is just horrible. There's not words that can express what a horrific experience that is and what Diane as a mother went through and continues to go through by losing her daughter and dealing with her other children and it happening at her home. Can you imagine a place where you live and it's supposed to be safe and sacred, but to know your daughter died right in front of your own home? Doug, what was the scene like around the house?
So, Glenview, Illinois, a town at that time of 37,000 people, had its own police department. But the part of Glenview that the Boccaccios lived in was not covered by the town police. Like many of these cities around Chicago, they're on Cook County. And it was the Cook County Sheriff's Office that was going to handle this case. But initially, the Glenview Police Department arrived. You can see from TV coverage at the time, the yellow tape out. And this
was later described as a blitz attack, a blitz, meaning sudden. And it was out in the open. This was not behind a house or shrubbery or inside a building. This was out on a side lawn that is pretty sizable and faces a number of homes, one of which had had a party late that night. So this was a brazen attack, no effort to cover it up, no effort to move Trisha's body. She was stabbed multiple times, I think more than a dozen, in different parts of her body, of course. Trisha's left arm also suffered a spiral fracture, which means it was twisted. And then she was found prone, laying face up on their side porch. And she had a car key because she just left her car in the parking area in front of their home. And that car key had a blood on it, which was later tested for DNA. And near the body was a bloody footprint. And again, her body was left out there to bleed out. No attempt to cover it up. No attempt to move it. Done in literally the wide open. Nighttime, but still, houses nearby, people at a party nearby. It was a pretty brazen attack. And the neighbors came by, some of them. And one of the neighbors, a guy from the next block over, a classmate of Doug Picaccio's, and this neighbor's name was Michael Gargiulo. And Michael Gargiulo came over to see what was happening also. And he was at the end of the driveway, by where it meets the street. And he was watching, and according to testimony, Rick Picaccio yelled at Michael Gargiulo, you know, to find out who did this. He needed to find out who did this to Trisha. And at that point, Rick Picaccio, through this whole time immediately after finding her body and with the police arriving, was very emotional and at times had to be restrained by people holding on to his belt loop. But at some point, he yells over to this neighbor kid, Michael Gargiulo, you got to find out who killed Trisha.
Trisha's family home was located on Huber Lane, less than 3 miles from the TGI Fridays where she was last seen alive. The night of her murder, her neighbors had been having a pool party across the street, which meant there was plenty of possible witnesses who might have seen or heard something. But when the police questioned people who were at the party, no one seemed to recall having noticed anything. Doug, tell us about the beginning of the investigation. Did the police have any leads or suspects?
Chris Picaccio is killed in a brutal fashion. Left to be found by your parents. The police that immediately responded were the Glenview Police Department, but the Picaccios lived in Cook County. And so the Cook County Sheriff's Department took over. Ultimately, that was not the best of news for the Picaccios. At that time, not so much today, but at that time, the Cook County Sheriff's Department was a political dumping ground. And there had been just the year before a scandal where 450 officers had been put on the force, either as correction officers or deputies, and had been given the entry-level test before or cheated in some way. And so the standards were not the highest. And when Trisha was murdered, there were still at least 350 people on this force. So the Cook County Sheriff's Department takes over. Many, as was pointed out later, many of the officers, the higher officers at the time who were handling this investigation, they too got kicked out for a variety of corruption reasons or Lord knows what. So in the first years of this investigation, I don't think anybody really knows where it went. The Picaccios, particularly Diane Picaccio, I mean, she claims, and I believe her, that she would go essentially every week to the local office of the Cook County Sheriff's Police and ask what's going on and virtually get no answers.
Can you imagine, as Diane claims, that she would go every week to the local office of the police station trying to get answers, trying to figure out what happened to her daughter, who killed her daughter, why did they kill her, and supposedly not get any answers to these questions. Here, she loses her daughter, who had such a bright and promising future while she was going to go off to college, but now that's never going to happen. And those dreams that her daughter had will never become a reality. And the mother is still trying to find answers, still trying to figure out who did this. Why did they do this? Why did this happen to a girl that had such a bright future and had so many friends and was popular and was so bright? And still, the mother didn't get the answers, but she kept persisting and kept trying to figure out what happened. Doug, you've spoken with Trisha's family on several occasions. What was life like for them after Trisha was murdered?
Following Trisha Petacchio's murder, her family, that family's life was turned upside down. Even today, I mean, if you speak with the parents, it's pretty close to being like Trisha was killed yesterday. The emotional toll on that family is profound and remains so. It was so profound at the time immediately following the murder that the family moved out of the house and moved in with Diane Picaccio's mother. In fact, as I understand it, they stayed out of the home for 4 years. Dad, Rick, would come over and cut the lawn and keep the outside maintained or fix things that might break in the home. But nobody lived in that house for 4 years. That was the impact.
The investigation stalled until 1997, when a new investigation team was assigned to the case. Doug, what were the new detectives investigating able to uncover that the previous investigators had not?
Eventually, a very good detective gets on the case, and he started focusing on a prime suspect. Let's call him Suspect A. And Suspect A had been a friend of Doug Picaccio's, didn't go to the same high school, but hung around. And at some point, Suspect A's, one of his relatives, close relatives, had told the police that they suspected that Suspect A had killed Trisha Picaccio. So all of the focus, all of it, went on Suspect A for a long time. And for example, when at the crime scene, there was a bloody footprint. Now it turned out to belong to Rick Picaccio, but nobody knew that for a while. And Suspect A, around the time that was revealed, got rid of some shoes that he owned. He did a variety of suspicious things, and that remained an important part of the investigation for a long time. And for a long time, from letters that the Picaccios wrote, they too were highly suspicious of Suspect A. However, in 1998, remember I mentioned the neighbor boy, Michael Gargiulo. By this point, Michael's graduated high school. The brother who was friends with Michael, Doug, has graduated high school. And so Doug's no longer in the home. He's at college, at university. But Michael Gargiulo, who over the years, between the murder and what I'm in 1993 and what I'm describing, is As I'm about to describe this home visit by him, Michael Gargiulo would give Rick Boccaccio gifts. Call what kind, but he would, from time to time, bring him gifts, which was a bit odd, but only odd at that time. I mean, nothing was really inferred, but it was odd. So one night, late afternoon, Michael Gargiulo comes over, comes into the house. Only Diane Boccaccio is there, and he wants to talk to Rick Boccaccio. He won't tell Diane why. He won't talk to Diane about anything. He said he'll only talk to Rick. Well, Rick comes home, and I don't remember if Rick gets home or if Michael's father gets there first. But I'm going to just put it this way. Ultimately, Michael Gargiulo never gets to speak to Rick Boccaccio that evening because Michael Gargiulo's father comes over to the house and pulls Michael out of the house, and that meeting with Rick never takes place. From what the Boccaccios told us in our later interviews with CBS News is that they began at that moment to suspect that Michael Gargiulo had something to do, knew something, more likely had something to do with the murder of their daughter.
What do you think Michael would have said? Would have Michael have told him that he did it? And why was Michael giving him the gifts? Did he give the gifts because he potentially felt guilty about something and that made him feel better? When I hear that Michael's father stopped him, what did Michael's father potentially know, and why did he stop him? What was he going to say to them? Was he going to say that it was an accident, that he did it? We don't know that. We don't know the answers to that because it never occurred. We can all guess or think what he might have said or would have said or why he gave the gifts. But ultimately, we really don't know. And what exactly was he going to tell the father? And why did he only want to talk to the father and not the wife? Those are questions that we just don't know.
Doug, what can you tell us about Michael Gargiulo? Was he close to the Boccaccio family?
So the scene of the crime was a short walk from where Michael Gargiulo lived. He lived on Waddell Lane, which was, as the crow flies, about 500 feet away from the Boccaccio house. It was to the next block to the east, a modest-sized house. Michael Gargiulo had a fair number of brothers and sisters, and they lived in the neighborhood for a very long time. Michael Gargiulo was 1 year younger than Tricia Boccaccio, and that made him about the same age as Tricia Boccaccio's brother, Doug. So Michael Gargiulo and Doug Boccaccio knew each other as little kids, and I think they did things together, closer friends when they were little, still knew each other in high school, and in fact, Doug played football, and Michael Gargiulo played football at least his sophomore and junior year. And I believe they often went to school together in, family cars shuttling back and forth. And but Michael Gargiulo had some behavioral problems. He was a bit of a hothead. Now, he's a teenager, and we probably could have described a lot of people in their teenage years with some of those qualities. But he did get in trouble with the police his senior year. He got into a fight in the parking lot of the high school and he did get a battery charge. Notably, he was not in the yearbook his senior year of high school, which I don't know the answer to that, why not, but he was not in the yearbook. I mean, he still went to the high school, but he was not in the yearbook. And over the years, he and Doug Picaccio were not as close as they were when they were little kids, but they were still friends and did see each other.
In May of 1997, Michael Gargiulo walked into Glenview Police Station to complain that he had been followed repeatedly by what he believed were various police agencies, according to documents obtained by the journal Entropics News. When a police officer recognized Michael as a suspect wanted by Libertyville police for vehicle burglary dating back to February 2nd, 1996, he was arrested and held for pickup. On May 31st, 1997, Michael Gargiulo confessed to going through unlocked cars in Glenview and taking a cell phone as well as a bag out of a van with another individual. Michael posted bond for the burglary in 1997, but the arrest gave Cook County detectives an opening to dig deeper into Michael's connection to Tricia. Doug, what happened when they spoke with him about the burglary charge?
As part of his criminal process, he was offered a plea deal. If he would, since he was a neighbor of the Picaccios, and he'd been a high school friend of Doug's and knew a bunch of the people in the high school who knew Tricia, the police wanted to talk to Gargiulo about what he knew, if anything, about Tricia's murder. And they were offering him a plea deal on the burglary charge, which was a felony, if he would talk to them about Tricia's murder. And he refused to do that. He refused to take the plea deal. He took whatever the punishment was. And that definitely made him a suspect at that point. He may have been a bit before, and he certainly was a lot afterwards. But that was the kind of behavior that made no sense to detectives at the time. And why wouldn't he take the deal if he, you know, and what was it that he didn't want to say about about Tricia's murder?
So Gargiulo doesn't talk to police and accepts a felony burglary charge. But for the time being, he's able to walk free while awaiting trial. He eventually moves to Hollywood, California to live with his older brother, Kenny. Shortly after arriving in Los Angeles, Cook County detectives managed to convince Gargiulo to fly back to Chicago to testify before a grand jury. According to Chicago Magazine, Gargiulo interviewed with Detective Jack Reed and Mark Baldwin prior to giving his testimony. That's where he made a shocking claim to detectives. Gargiulo said his friend, Suspect A, had admitted to killing Tricia. At that time, the detectives were sure Suspect A was responsible for the murder. But when Gargiulo was brought before the grand jury, he changed his story, making it seem as if his friend was joking. Gargiulo's friend moved out of the state and was never charged. Detectives eventually tracked him down and spent 6 hours trying to persuade him to speak with them, but he demanded immunity, which Cook County refused. Gargiulo stopped talking to the police and would eventually plead guilty to the burglary. He was released on 18-month probation and given a $200 fine, according to a court disposition obtained by the journal Entropics. Free again, he returned to the bright lights of Los Angeles, where he would pursue a career in acting. In our next episode, we'll follow Gargiulo to Los Angeles, where he would meet a 22-year-old named Ashley Ellerin, and the Hollywood Ripper story begins to unfold.